brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
All right, welcome to Capital Thinking, the last Thursday in the month of June. Getting ready for July 4th holiday next week, and as we prepare to celebrate American freedom and maybe have some hot dogs with the Iranians. Well, we're going to spend this week's episode of Capital Thinking talking about key streams of restoring financial freedom to America. Financial regulation remains a hot topic in Washington, D.C., and our whole hour is devoted to that. Our guests here in our first segment, two experts from the law firm of Patton Boggs. We've got Travis Siegmiller with us. Travis is a former staffer for the Senate Judiciary Committee, and he is joined by Todd Cranford. Todd's a frequent appearer here on Capital Thinking, is a former counsel to the House Financial Services Committee and Chairman Barney Frank. So, Travis and Todd, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thanks, Kevin.
Well, guys, busy week on the Hills ever since last week's announcement by the President that he'd like to see financial regulatory reform get done here in the near future and has called for some ambitious new proposals. Todd, why don't you start out telling us a little bit about the state of play on what the President has proposed and how it's been initially received.
Well, yeah, Kevin, as you just noted, no surprise to anyone that the President did propose, as I think you said, a very ambitious program for regulatory reform of the financial system, which is including merging some agencies, getting rid of some agencies, and much to the chagrin of some conservative Democrats and many Republicans, forming new agencies. I'm sure that the President and his supporters would say that it is a net loss or no net gain in federal agencies with those that are being abolished and those that he's seeking to create. But I think that many of the Republicans are not going to feel that way and will argue the opposite when the time comes. The Financial Services Committee, well, actually, let me back up and first say that it appears at this point that the majority of the heavy lifting is going to come from the administration and from the House. It's our understanding that much of the reform package is being drafted in the first instance by the White House and in conjunction with the House. The Senate is very busy right now with health care and with nominations and is not likely to work on a package of its own and will just address whatever the House sends over. When the House will send it over is still up for debate, but it appears that they will try to get something on the President's desk by the end of the year. The initial schedule that Mr. Frank sent out last week announcing a series of hearings, almost two or three a week, between now and the end of the August, or right just before the August recess, is going to keep the members busy, trying to address all facets of the proposal, from consumer protection to the systemic risk regulator, to how do we better manage the existing regulatory organizations.
Travis, let me jump in here and ask you, this new proposed agency of President Obama's, how does it differ or complement the other things, the other alphabet soup of agencies that we already have, and what's been the reaction of the banking and insurance industries, among others?
Yeah, there's actually there's two big categories of new entity. There's one that you've just mentioned, what people are calling it the CFPA, or the Consumer Financial Protection Agency, and then the other one is the NBS, or the National Bank Supervisor. You heard Todd mention that as the systemic risk regulator. And in those two categories, just to check them off quickly, the new systemic risk regulator is the entity that would consolidate what would have formerly been the currency and the OTS, the Office of Thrift Supervision. So the idea there is to put those two entities, the OTS and the OCC, into its own new agency with separate status within the Treasury called the National Bank Supervisor, and the administration's proposal was that should be led by its own sort of single executive. So what's going on at the OCC and the OTS can be a one-stop shop under the new NBS, the National Bank Supervisor. But that's one big category. But the other one that's getting the most, and that category was expected. Most of us expected it to look very much, the proposal looked very much like it came down. One that has been, that's getting a lot more excitement and getting a lot of chatter from both the consumer protection folks as well as industry, and you mentioned some of the industry players who really care, is the new Consumer Financial Protection Agency that the Obama administration proposed. And what this entity would do, the idea is create a new entity that would supervise financial products like credit cards, mortgage-related products, insurance, but it would not include investment products of the sort that currently regulated by the SEC and the CFTC. By the way, the SEC and the CFTC would stay separate. There was some chatter that perhaps the CFTC would be folded into the SEC, or some of the authorities of the CFTC folded into the SEC, and that's not the case. In the Obama proposal, he proposed to still keep them separate. But anyway, the entities that are regulated by those two, the SEC and the CFTC, would not be regulated by the Consumer Financial Protection Agency. And we can get into more detail what this new entity would probably do, the new Consumer Protection Agency. We've been meeting with staff on both sides of the aisle, in the House and the House Energy and Commerce Committee, as well as the House Financial Services Committee, to get our brains around it as best as possible and to hear what the latest and hottest thinking is on it. And the truth is, the subtle details about what the new agency will look like and what it will do are not out there yet. We've been told by a variety of staff that and on the House side, that they themselves are still waiting for more detail, even perhaps proposed legislative text written by the White House or from the administration about what this new entity would look like.
Let me ask you guys this. You know, I understand the need perhaps for a systemic regulator, given how that drove the recession we're in. I don't understand the need for a consumer protection agency that's focused on credit cards and some of these other products you mentioned, because that doesn't seem to be the driving force behind the recession. That seems to me like there's an awful lot of regulation already there at the state and federal level. How much protecting the consumer from themselves needs to go on at the federal level?
Well, I think you raise a very good point, Kevin. And there are a lot of members on both sides of the aisle who are asking that very same question. And I think it highlights the need for to remember that not every proposal that's coming out of the administration in the midst of this economic crisis is going to be substantively necessary. Because I think you do make a good point that there is a significant amount of regulation already being done by current federal regulators and more importantly, on the state level, for many of the products that this umbrella agency would take up. And it's going to be one of the biggest points of contention during the debate on what will shape this agency. How far will it regulate? Will it go beyond ensuring that practices are consistent and fair and that they don't defraud consumers? Or will it go further and actually rule on the worthiness and the suitability of certain financial products that heretofore have been regulated by the states? And so that's going to be tough, but in this atmosphere of, and I hesitate to say hysteria, but I think many people were on the verge of that, and so many of these proposals are coming from the perspective that something has to be done, and so they may overreach in an effort to ensure that they don't underreach as Congress has been accused of doing in the past with their laissez-faire, hands-off, deregulatory mode that they have been in for several years.
Well, I think I'd like to get your feedback, guys, on it seems like we get very mixed messages out of Washington these days. You know, I read earlier this week Barney Frank was pushing some banks and whatnot to relax their lending standards and get out there again. At the same time, it seems to me anytime you put a new regulatory agency out there, this systemic risk group or this consumer protection agency, the net result of that is going to be to discourage the people who have money from distributing it out and getting consumer spending again. I mean, is there sort of a clash of ideas here? Do they understand they're contradicting themselves?
I don't want to monopolize, Travis, if you have something.
Travis, I think that's his way of saying he doesn't want to answer that question.
I was pausing to say, gosh, yeah, I mean, certainly there's those who would say yes and those who would say no, and those that would say my perspective is that the precise answering that question is the precise point of the whole policymaking process up here. As both sides of the aisle, thinkers from both sides from the variety of perspectives come together to answer that question and solve the problem and find where the line is that we can be happy with. In talking to staff, and this is speaking of House staff specifically, there is still a genuine question in a lot of smart people's minds about the way this is all going to shake out. And so, for example, in last week there was a lot of questions coming out of Wall Street and from the investment community as to what percentage of the how much the final deal the regulatory agencies of the future would look like the Obama proposal. Because the first gut reaction when you see a big proposal coming out in the fancy way that it came out was to, read the headlines and think, gosh, this is the way it's going to be. And so part of our job is to sift through all of that and get to the subtleties of which proposals are the ones that are likely to actually happen, what the probability of them actually occurring, what the impacts on certain industries will be if they do or do not, et cetera. And so sorting through all those complexities is still the ongoing process. That's what's going to be going on the whole rest of this summer, and that's why it takes a lot of hard work from a lot of smart people. But to speak from the perspective of the other side of the aisle, there are those who the reason, sort of the policy argument for this new Consumer Financial Protection Agency, in part the easy argument is that a big problem, the way that we got into this mess in the first place, one of the reasons we got into this mess in the first place is that consumers were led to make bad choices. And the consumers themselves, the government did not protect consumers enough from the greedy folks in whatever, at whatever level of the food chain. And that's how we ended up with people getting predatory loans, people buying houses they couldn't afford.
Guys, I'm going to have to cut it off there. Travis and Todd, we're going to continue this discussion later this summer as this heats up. Appreciate you guys coming on the show. We'll be back in just a minute to talk more about the financial sector. Until then, keep it here on Capital Thinking.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Parents, did you know that high school dropouts make 42% less than graduates? Someone will have to make up that difference, and chances are, that will be you. That means paying 42% of their groceries.
Ooh, more candy.
42% of their dentist bills.
No more candy.
Even 42% of their therapy sessions.
It's all my dad's fault.
Save your money. Encourage your kids to stay in school. For help and advice, call 877-FORAKID. A message from the U.S. Army and the Ad Council.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order. Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs, straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back to the show. Well, we just got done talking a little bit about the regulatory reform process that's taking place on the Hill. But much of the nation's attention has been riveted this year during our recession on governmental actions taken directly in what we used to call the free capital markets. Joining us for this segment is Michael Richman. Michael is the head of the bankruptcy practice for the law firm of Patton Boggs and a nationally recognized expert in the field of bankruptcy law. And, Michael, welcome to the show again. How are you doing today?
I'm great, Kevin. It's nice to be back with you on the show. Thank you.
Well, listen, we're having you on because many Americans very intrigued and many Americans very upset with the notion that the federal government has had to not only bail out a number of private companies, but to take direct equity interest in those companies to the extent that perhaps they might be running them and semi-nationalizing them. You represent a group of General Motors bondholders who are very upset with the process that has gone down with the government bailout and subsequent takeover of that company. And why don't we start at the top and tell us a little bit about who they are and what their concerns are with what's happened.
Yeah, thanks. Yes, we're representing a group that we call the Unofficial Committee of Family and Dissident GM Bondholders. And this group, the committee itself is three bondholders, but through a website called Main Street Bondholders, they are networked with nearly 2,000 bondholders around the country. These are non-institutional kind of regular people who bought GM bonds for their savings accounts because they were told that they were very safe and that they would produce good interest income. There are many retirees in the group. Unlike institutional traders, who the kinds of people that the president labeled speculators, most of the people that we are representing or the interests that we're representing in this paid probably at or near par value for the bonds, and these are substantial investments, and they're going to be hurt badly by the kinds of distributions that are being discussed in the case. And so we are really leading the opposition to the attempt by the government and General Motors to run the creation of new GM in a fast-track sale, rather than what we're arguing is that if they want to create a new GM, they should do it in a conventional Chapter 11 plan, which would protect creditors' rights, have greater transparency and due process, and obviously we would hope it would lead to greater recoveries for the bondholders than is what is already being presented.
Michael, let's walk back for our audience's sake to understand this in a little more detail. Let's walk through some of the basics of bankruptcy law and talk about, I mean, the whole idea of being a preferred creditor compared to the average Joe who has some money owed to them by GM. Can you walk us through what would normally happen in a regular bankruptcy for people like these bondholders?
Yeah, well, the general rule is that creditors whose claims are legally the same should be treated equally and get the same distributions. The bondholders of GM, whether they're institutional or tiny, are unsecured claims. they have the same legal priority as vendors, suppliers, and employees and unions. They're all unsecured, and therefore the general principle should be that they all get the same distributions. Now, there are many cases, and the rules on distribution are part of Section 1129 of the Bankruptcy Code, which has the various rules and policies for confirming a Chapter 11 plan. There are cases where unsecured creditors are divided into different groups and they aren't given exactly the same treatment. And so there is a permission to do that. However, creditors can object if they believe that the proposed distribution to another class presents an unfair discrimination as to their class. So you can discriminate, but you can't discriminate unfairly. So there have been cases, it's been pointed out in the press, that labor unions in GM so far are getting a highly preferential distribution on their unsecured claims as compared to the bondholders. It's been pointed out that there is precedent for unions and representing employees to get better treatment because of the important need to have the unions on board if you want to have a successful company. But the extent of that preference should be subject to the unfair discrimination test of Section 1129 under a conventional plan. But the way the government and GM is proposing to implement this through a sale that is being concocted for Section 363, they would not have to respect the unfair discrimination rules. I hope that wasn't too complex.
Well, you know, there were a couple of section references that got my head spinning, but I got the gist of it. Let me ask you this. You mentioned the preference. I mean, give us a sense of ultimately how many pennies on the dollar are the bondholders getting out of the government for the GM situation versus what the labor unions are getting.
Yeah, well, that's here's how that goes. The total size of the labor union claims, the UAW claims, is estimated to be about $20 billion. The bondholder claims are $27 billion. All right. So right off the bat, if you know that, and both groups are going to be getting equity in new GM, you would think that bondholders should get more than the labor unions because they have $27 million in versus $20 million. The way the plan has been proposed for the Fast Track 363 sale, the labor union is going to get 17.5% of the equity, and the bondholders are only going to get 10% of the new equity. And not only that, the labor unions are also going to get preferred stock and a $2.5 billion note and some other benefits. So it is a very wide disparity that we do not believe would stand to close scrutiny if this were being done in a Chapter 11 plan with plan protections.
And tell us, I know you've gotten some press coverage. You all were in court recently. Walk us through a little bit about what your claim involved and where that process stands.
Well, you know, it's been a whirlwind, I will tell you, Kevin. We got engaged by this group probably only about 10 days ago. And the first thing that we had to do was we did two things, actually. One is we filed a motion to have the bankruptcy court declare us to be an official creditors committee rather than being an unofficial committee. And we wanted to do that because if you're an official committee, your fees and expenses and the fees and expenses of any experts you retain are paid for by the company, the same way that the regular creditors committee and the debtors are paid. And that has obvious advantages, particularly if you need to retain experts and you want to mount a significant contest in the court. Resources do matter. And we also filed last Friday a very substantive objection to the Section 363 fast track sale, which, as I've said before, is what we think they're using to create this unfair discrimination and to end run the plan requirements. The hearing on our motion for official committee recognition was 2 days ago, and you probably saw some of the press. The judge denied our request. We were not surprised in the sense that it really is unusual to gain official committee recognition. We knew it was a long shot, and given the various political and legal considerations, you know, it was just not something that we had high hopes for, but we still felt we had a shot at it, which is why we did it, and I'm proud of the effort that we made. The next step will be well. What's happening right now is there are depositions. There's a witness list that's been published for witnesses that GM is going to start presenting on Tuesday next week, and we are participating in depositions of those witnesses to prepare to mount a contest at next week's sale hearing, which is scheduled to begin in the morning on Tuesday, but will likely last for 2 or 3 days.
Hey, tell me real quickly, we've got about 3 minutes before the break, and we're going to spend some more time with you after the break, but I know this Indiana official filed suit against the federal government, I believe, over the Chrysler bankruptcy on sort of similar lines, saying that you know, teachers' unions and some public workers lost out in that reorganization, and the Supreme Court seemed to turn it down. Does that case have any sort of bearing on where you're headed here?
Well, yes and no. I'll give you the headline, and we can also continue after the break on this, but you're referring to the Indiana pension funds, and they basically took over as the main dissidents in the Chrysler case after the non-TARP lender group fell apart. You remember early in Chrysler, you had this so-called non-TARP lender group that were secured creditors that were unhappy with their recoveries. They're the ones the president labeled speculators. And their lawyer was Tom Laurier from White & Case, who got a lot of press for taking the Indiana pension funds, you know, and the objections first directly to the Second Circuit and then to the Supreme Court. When I say it has an impact, you know, going in different directions, Chrysler was a very different case from GM, and so you know, I'm taking different tactics for very different reasons, which I'll elaborate on after the break. I also think it's very significant that what the Indiana pension funds were trying to do was really liquidate Chrysler. They were basically saying we could do better if the company just liquidates. But that was a losing position from a political standpoint, because the only reason the government was involved was to preserve the company. We're not arguing that GM should liquidate. We're saying it's fine if you want to create new GM with the best assets. All we're saying is, as a matter of substantive and procedural due process and creditors' rights, do it in a Chapter 11 plan. Don't do it, you know, in under a fast-track 363 sale, which denies creditors' rights.
Interesting. That's, I think, a pretty important distinction, that you guys want to be part of GM going forward, but you want to be fully protected, and you want to see your investment given the credit it deserves.
That's exactly right.
We're chatting with Michael Richmond from the law firm of Patton Boggs. He represents a dissident class of GM bondholders upset with the government's plan for reorganization. We're going to come back in just a minute after a couple commercials, spend some more time talking about the implications of this case for the broader market in general.
Whether the market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patton Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hola.
Konnichiwa.
Bonjour.
Hello.
From Anchorage to Abu Dhabi.
Merhaba.
From Denver to Doha.
Ciao.
Patton Boggs makes business transactions the world over.
Oi.
Rely on our insights for your next deal. Patton Boggs, the international business team. Straight, unfiltered, Patton Boggs.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio. Voice America Business Network.
Washington. It's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, we're continuing our discussions with Michael Richman, head of the bankruptcy group for the law firm of Patton Boggs in New York City, one of the nation's leading authorities on various elements of bankruptcy law, and a guy who's currently representing a number of bondholders in General Motors who are concerned that the government intervention and the process by which they are reorganizing that company has shorted bondholders of their legal rights and perhaps set some very important negative precedents for the business community going forward that really impact our ability to revive this economy. Michael, I know that we were chatting before the break a little bit about what happened last week in court, and now you've got some pretty important things coming up in the next week. Tell us a little bit about the next steps for the bondholders here and what the likelihood of success is there in court.
Well, you know, we are going to do our best to make a contest out of the hearings next week in which the government and GM are trying to have the court approve this fast-track 363 sale. You know, when they filed the bankruptcy case on June 1st, they told the world, the White House press secretary said, we hope GM will be out in 60 to 90 days. And Fritz Henderson, the new CEO of GM, made similar comments. And we think the GM can be out in 60 to 90 days under a plan, under a Chapter 11 plan. So the question is, why are they now claiming there's some kind of emergency which requires this fast-track 363 sale to accomplish everything in only 30 days? And I think the obvious answer, as I indicated before, is because they don't want to follow the requirements for a plan because they have arranged for the equity to be divided in ways that might not be legally supportable under a plan. You asked before about Chrysler, and I said that after the break I'd point out another very big difference, and that is this. In Chrysler, which was also done on a fast-track 363 sale and a claim that, you know, the company was going to melt down if we didn't go along with that sale and do it quickly, there was a third-party purchaser who was driving the deadlines. That was Fiat. Fiat said, if we can't buy this company by such and such a date, we're going to walk. That was real economic pressure from a legitimate commercial party. In this case, there is no such independent purchaser. The government, is our government, is creating a shell company that's going to take ownership of new GM. So when they say, we need to have it done by June 30 or July 10, that's not a commercial decision driven by an automobile manufacturer who's making a judgment about assets. It's a political decision. To say that GM has the business judgment that this must be done or there will be dire consequences is a fiction. And if you look at the newspapers reporting on GM's performance, guess what? Since they filed bankruptcy on June 1, they've sold more cars and trucks than they did in May. So they're not really hurting that bad. And so the claims that this has to be done on such a fast track really seem to us to be unsupportable, and that is going to be a main line of attack that we are going to pursue in the bankruptcy court next week in the hope that the court will say, you know what, you haven't made a strong enough case to do this under Section 363. Go do it under a plan.
Interesting. I know in talking to a lot of my friends, nothing frustrates them more about this whole process of the federal government engaging in taking over many of these companies, and GM in particular, and doing some of the things that they did. You know, it's interesting that GM has hired somebody who hasn't been in the car business to turn it around, but that, you know, I feel like in my area, at least, we're getting carpet bombed with TV ads for the new GM about, you know, basically what a patriotic message it would be to make sure my next car is a GM, and my wife always turns and comments to me, I'm paying for that ad.
Right, and that's the thing that frustrates people, too, about the fact that the government could be using our dollars to discriminate among classes of creditors. That's just, you know, that outrages a lot of people, and justifiably so. You would think that since all the money here is coming from us anyway, how can you favor one group of your citizens over another? It just doesn't seem right.
Well, and especially when the group being favored is so nakedly partisan. You know, the union's obviously huge supporters of the Obama administration, getting them elected in Democratic Congress. And it would seem in many respects, I mean, they're the folks who should be standing in line saying, we'll do anything to keep our job.
Well, a lot of people have said that. And you know, I've tried very hard not to make political statements about it, even though I understand that people feel that way. I appreciate, if I try to be as utterly fair as I can be, that, you know, you can't have a company without employees that are willing to work, and if the union controls the employees, that it gives them some leverage. But my view is, stick to the law. You know,
right.
If they have leverage, and it means that they have to get something more than somebody else, it still should be proportional. It can't be unfair.
Well, talk to me.
I'm looking at it that way, but I appreciate that point of view.
Well, I know you're not a policy guy. You're a dreaded real lawyer. But talk to me a little bit about the business and political implications of what's going on here. I mean, if you were advising, here you have these big bondholders that you work with, why would they ever want to invest going forward in any company that they believe is susceptible to being taken over by the government or requiring government bailout, knowing that it could really dilute their ability to be made whole in the long run?
Well, you know, it's a legitimate concern that, you know, the bond market generally is going to be dampened if you're in an economic environment where people think that the government can come in and not give you the full legal rights that you are entitled to as a bondholder. And the secured creditors in Chrysler were outraged for the same reasons. I think that you know, there's a debate about that, and I don't know, and it is a policy debate, because on the one hand you could say, you know, this is a terrible precedent, and it's going to just restrain investing, and it's going to be bad for capitalism and bad for business. On the other hand, people argue, well, this is so extraordinary. What's going on now is never going to happen again. There's always risk if you invest in a company that may get distressed and may need to be restructured. And, you know, once things stabilize, maybe the market comes back to normal. So it's hard for me as a lawyer to know how that comes out. But it's a lot easier for me to say, hey, the point is the government shouldn't be able to do that. GM shouldn't be able to do that. Equally, legally equal creditors should be treated equally, whether they're bond claimants or tort claimants or general vendors or labor unions.
Yeah, I think it's probably pretty disturbing to anybody who follows these things on a legal basis to think that, you know, the law is the law until the government decides that there's a special emergency situation and the law isn't the law anymore.
Well, and more to that point, Kevin, you know, I don't know whether the government has the legal authority to nationalize GM, but I imagine that they could have done that had they wanted to, or asked Congress for legislation if that's what they, and I guess if they'd nationalized GM, they could have done whatever they wanted. But you know what? They didn't. They chose to go into Chapter 11. Well, if you're going to go into Chapter 11, I think you have to obey the rules. You don't get to just say, hey, you know what? I want to use this part of Chapter 11 and that part of Chapter 11, but that other part of Chapter 11 with creditors' rights, I really don't want to have to deal with that provision. That's just not right. If you go into Chapter 11 because that's how you want to restructure the company, then follow all the rules.
Well, let me back up, Michael. I know you're involved. You've at least followed closely some of the other government actions here. Well, actually, let me take it back. I got another question that's more pressing in my mind. The Chrysler case went all the way to the Supreme Court on a pretty fast track. Now, you just outlined for us earlier in this segment where you see things going in the next week or two. Is it possible you'll get all the way to the highest court in the land with this, and will it happen quickly?
Well, Kevin, I like to think that I've got a good chance of persuading Bankruptcy Judge Gerber to see it our way, and going to the appellate courts and the Supreme Court won't be necessary. But if you're asking me, will we go that far if we lose, I have to say I honestly don't know. I think that, as we saw in the Chrysler situation, that bankruptcy is so specialized that once it gets past the bankruptcy judge, the rest of the appellate system tends to show substantial deference to the bankruptcy judge and the determinations made in the bankruptcy court. And, you know, I mentioned earlier that the group we're representing really has limited means. And so whether we have, on a cost-benefit basis, the resources available to really mount that kind of an appeal, you know, I have to say is an open question. I mean, on a personal level, would I love to be able to argue this at the Second Circuit and at the Supreme Court? You bet.
Careful what you wish for.
Yeah, I just don't know whether it will make sense for us on a cost-benefit basis, and I'm really hoping that we can prevail in front of Judge Gerber and persuade him that the government and GM can do everything that they want to try to do here, but just follow the law and just take a little longer to do it. We don't want to see them liquidate. We just want them to reorganize in the right way.
Well, I got about 90 seconds left for you to answer this question. What's your advice to companies and bondholders going forward to avoid some of the legal landmines that are being thrown out by these extraordinary cases?
Oh, boy. You know, I don't know that you can avoid, you know, we're in such an extraordinary time right now, you know, with the distress, you know, in many parts of our business world. But certainly people could see that the trouble with the automotive industry was brewing for a long time. You know, I feel badly for the people, largely those in the group that I represent, who did not have the sophisticated tools, you know, to tell them, hey, you really should sell your bonds because you're going to get hurt in bankruptcy. And it really frustrates me on a personal level when I see, you know, the large institutions probably all bought their bonds at pennies on the dollar, so they're going to be profiting from the distributions made in the case. But the people I represent are losing money, and I wish there was a better way, but it just isn't right. Even if we succeed in improving the distributions to them as a group, they're probably still going to be hurting much more in terms of real loss than the institutions.
One of the big ironies of all this, since bonds were supposedly the safe investment you made to get you through the ups and downs of the stock market.
That's right.
And apparently it couldn't be further from the truth in this case. Well, Michael, as we wrap up here, do you want to provide folks with your email address if they have questions or they want to talk more to you about bankruptcy issues?
You can send me an email, you know, or shoot a call. Email is the best way to get in touch with me, I think, these days, given how crazy things are. And that's mrichman@pattenbox.com, M-R-I-C-H-M-A-N at pattenbox.com.
Well, we will wish you and the bondholders you represent some fantastic luck. I know a lot of Americans are frustrated with the degree of control that the government has exerted here and the way in which they have treated folks that are similarly situated in a disparate fashion. And so we'll wish you guys good luck in court in the days ahead. We'll watch the case carefully and look to have you back on to talk about your win here sometime in the near future. We're going to come back and talk about the political headlines of the day after this commercial break. Until then, keep it here on the Voice America Network.
Markets up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now toll free 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Stewart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Stewart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, @pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, thanks for sticking with us on this show. We've been talking a little bit about what's going on in the financial world, both politics, law, and business. We hit financial reform and what the president has going with Congress in the first segment. It's been a fascinating half hour talking with Michael Richman about the GM case where the federal government has intervened and really sort of dropped the hammer on a bunch of people who invested a lot of money in that company and then had to stand in line behind other politically preferred groups in order to collect, even though the law was on their side. I think it would be very interesting to see how that case turns out. Well, let's turn to the headlines of the day in Washington, the big issues. I guess that the events of the last 48 hours means that the producer of this radio show is not going to send me on a remote location to Argentina anytime soon to check out their political climate. You know, look, lots of politicians have obviously had the types of problems that have occurred with Governor Sanford. Just doing a quick mental list in my head in the last couple years, you've got Elliot Spitzer in New York. He resigned. You got Jim McGreevy of New Jersey. He ends up resigning. I think from a political perspective, it's hard to see how Governor Sanford survives a few days, let alone a few weeks before he is pushed out unceremoniously in South Carolina, a state where, politically speaking, you would think would have very low tolerance for their chief elected official engaging in the kind of conduct that he's admitted to in the last week. And I don't think it's the affair per se about all this. I think it is the fact that here you have people that are engaged in a position of trust and responsibility to serve other people, and they spend their day talking about their commitment to you and I as taxpayers and what they're going to do for us and how they'll always keep their word, and yet in their private life, in the actions that they take that most carefully reveal who they really are and the values they hold dearest to them, they're unable to fulfill their promises to their spouses, and therefore a lot of people say, well, you know, if you're not gonna fulfill your promises to your spouse and your family, How are you gonna do the things you promised to do for me on election day? So I really feel for the Sanford family, Mrs. Sanford, those four boys. You got to feel for them. She put out what I thought was perhaps a statement full of tremendous grace last night about how she will do her best to rebuild the family. But it's a really sad situation, and it's a sad situation on the national political scene. Governor Sanford was thought highly of, was thought to be preparing a run for the White House in a couple of years, and I would say that he is not on the radar screen anymore for the Republican Party as a national elected official. Now, what's that mean for others? Well, I'll give you a couple names where I think Sanford's situation means a couple people will jump into the void. Start with Mississippi Governor Haley Barbour. It didn't take but a couple of hours yesterday for Governor Sanford to step down as the chairman of the Republican Governors Association and for him to be replaced immediately by Haley Barbour, who's a second-term governor from Mississippi. Now, Haley Barbour's another guy that could be one of the dark horses for the White House in a couple years. The biggest strike against him is that before he went home to Mississippi to run for governor, he was one of the most successful lobbyists in Washington, D.C., and a former chairman of the Republican National Committee some time ago. He was tremendously successful at his profession, but of course right now lobbyists are somewhat of a scarlet letter profession, and so it will be interesting to see whether or not Governor Barbour can step into the vacuum with conservative voters that's been created by the Sanford departure here. The Governor Barbour has been out campaigning in some of the, or I shouldn't say campaigning, he's been out strategically visiting some of the states where early primaries and caucuses take place in 2012, and that's always a sign of high interest by folks. Two other names I give you, certainly Sarah Palin is someone who would look to step into the void and appeal to some of the good folks that might otherwise have been supportive of a Mark Sanford. Her message of economic conservatism appeals to much of what Sanford appealed to politically. And I also think Mitt Romney. Now, here's a guy who's probably made every right move politically since the 2000, since he lost in 2007's primaries for the Republican nomination. He campaigned hard for the McCain-Palin ticket. He acted like a good soldier when he wasn't chosen as the vice presidential nominee, something he's probably pretty thankful for today. He's been out making all the rounds since then, raising money for people at all levels of the Republican Party, been a constant, persistent, and a very well-spoken critic of the president, and, you know, guy with a rock-solid marriage and a well-known and a well-regarded family. I think that, those are people who could benefit politically from the Sanford situation. Well, a couple big issues hitting Congress this week on the legislative front. Tomorrow there's going to be a vote on the cap-and-trade legislation in the House of Representatives. That's going to be a fascinating vote. As we sit here today, Speaker Nancy Pelosi, White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel, and other Democratic Party leaders in the House are engaged in whipping their fellow Democrats, trying to drum up the votes needed to pass this signature item of the Obama, Reid, Pelosi troika here in Washington, D.C. This is legislation that would completely rework the environmental industry in the United States and have a huge impact worldwide. It would basically force our industries to reduce their carbon levels and pay for the privilege of using the carbon that they use today. Key breakthrough made earlier this week when Democrats negotiated with farm state Democrats in the House to make some concessions to them about who would handle oversight of farm implementation of these issues. And it remains to be seen, though. Here we are, it's 1 o'clock on Thursday almost. Right now it's an open question as to whether or not they'll get the votes needed to squeak through this bill in the House. It looks like, in typical fashion in 2009, House Republicans will be largely united, if not completely united, in opposing this bill. They call it the largest cap-and-spend bill in American history, arguing that it's a massive indirect tax on American consumers for the carbon that they consume, and that the costs are being dramatically underestimated by the Democratic Congress and their environmental allies. So if you're interested at all in the recovery of the American economy, you should be tuning in tomorrow to C-SPAN and checking out that vote, because I think you'll hear some fascinating political rhetoric, and I think it's going to be a very close vote. I wouldn't expect to see Democrats prevail by more than a handful of votes, certainly no more than 10 or 15, if what we're hearing is true now. A couple other big issues. The president this week, as if he didn't have enough to do, has had some allies out saying that we are absolutely positively going to get immigration reform teed up and done here in 2009. And you wonder, where do we find the time? I was with a number of political figures in a variety of settings this week, all of whom are senators and representatives complaining about the workload they've been laboring under this year in comparison to other years, and their staffs completely overworked through a logjam of trying to get health care reform, cap and trade, the spending bill, the stimulus package, all done in such a short time frame, and to add immigration reform, another huge multi-piece puzzle with varying political fights in it to the mix. It's a sign either of Obama's strength or his fear that if he doesn't get it done now, he may not be able to get it done anytime soon. So look for that. Going to be a fascinating week here in the Capitol. We're going to join you next week. We're going to take a look at some foreign affairs issues and also the hot topics of the day on Capitol Hill. I wish everyone a great, fantastic summer weekend. We will see you next Thursday at noon for another edition of Capitol Thinking. Until then, keep it locked on the Voice America Business Network.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program, brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.